Once upon a time in France, there was a young woman called...
On l'appelle Mademoiselle de Paris.
And she was unmarried, and everyone was okay with that because she was under 25.
C'est la rue de Rivoli.
And it was romantic. It was France.
On dit qu'elle est petite et mince, et s'il est vrai qu'elle n'est pas grande, que de bouquets et de guirlandes a-t-elle semé sur nos...
Wait a minute. Mademoiselle? They still say that in France? Miss? Yes. The French even still sing songs about Mademoiselle this and Mademoiselle that.
Il met du sabon et des chaussures à talons et des fleurs dans son chignon.
But today it's with a twist. Like in this song, which is sung by a woman who in the video is dressed as a man. And get this, the song is about a man who dresses up as a woman.
Ça fait appeler mademoiselle.
The term mademoiselle has clearly got issues these days. So many issues, in fact, that the French government is giving up on it. We'll be getting the latest from our French connection, Madame Adeline Cyr. We'll also hear from Russian, Vietnamese and Arabic speakers on the broadcast news jargon they dislike the most. But we're headed first to Hong Kong, where just in the past few days, the official census has come out. And with a big headline, English is no longer the second most commonly used language. Of course, Cantonese is the most commonly used language. Overtaking English is Mandarin, the language of mainland China, the language of the government. A literal translation, in fact, of what the Chinese call Mandarin is the common language. Does that mean that the people of Hong Kong are enhancing their language skills by adding Mandarin to Cantonese? Maybe a bit, but that doesn't account for it all, not by a long way. And what about the English speakers? Are they learning Mandarin? No, not really. Not in big numbers anyway. What these new census numbers do point to is that Mandarin speakers from the mainland are flocking to Hong Kong. And in greater numbers now than at any time in the past nearly 15 years since Hong Kong went from British rule to become part of China. And guess what? A lot of people in Hong Kong, they don't like this influx of new people and a new language. I mean, they don't even think of themselves as Chinese in the first place. There was a recent video that went viral that calls the mainland Chinese who come to Hong Kong, it calls them locusts who use up Hong Kong's resources. And the language differences in particular have got people really riled up, not just in Hong Kong, but in Beijing's corridors of power too. Here's the Big Show's Mary Kay Magstad reporting from Hong Kong.
It started on the subway. A Hong Kong guy told a mainland mother who was letting her kid eat dry noodles and drop some on the floor that eating wasn't allowed on the train. Other mainland Chinese sitting nearby mocked the Hong Kong guy's less than perfect Mandarin. He retorted that this was Hong Kong. They should be speaking the language here, Cantonese. A verbal feud broke out and police came in. It was captured on video. Eventually, the guy told another Hong Konger who'd come to his defense, "Don't bother. Mainlanders are just like this." The video went viral. Some Hong Kongers called the guy a hero. A Peking University professor called Kong Qingdong hit back on a talk show in Beijing. He said, "We're in China. We don't have to speak local dialects. Everyone should speak Mandarin. As for the many Hong Kongers who don't want to, they're bastards. They used to be British running dogs, now they're just dogs." That video went viral too. So did a music video out of Hong Kong. It puts new words to a popular cantopop song. It calls mainlanders locusts and depicts them as stealing, cheating, lying. It says, thanks to mainland China, Hong Kong is deteriorating inch by inch. Some young Hong Kongers have even sung this as mainland tourists walk by. Chun Qixi is a mainland graduate student at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She says a friend of hers was harassed in town when she was heard speaking Mandarin on the phone to her mother.
At this time, two Hong Kong people came to her and, 吐口水 on her. Like a
They spat on her because she was speaking Mandarin.
Yes. So my friend just cried and called me for help. This makes me very angry. Maybe there are always some extremist people, and I don't like their attitude.
Chun Shixi is young and hip and open to Hong Kong culture. She even speaks some Cantonese. And she says most Hong Kongers are nice to her. But they do kind of look down on mainland Chinese.
In their mind, Chinese people is people who are less cultivated or something like that. So they don't want to admit that I'm a Chinese. They will just say I'm a Hong Konger.
At the same university, government studies professor Ma Ok suggests a few reasons why Hong Kongers might be feeling this way.
Some people were worried that the mainland tourists came down and pushed prices, local consumer prices, up. And for the lower class immigrants, some were worried that they took away welfare and then could become a burden to Hong Kong society. And the most recent debate was, of course, about mainland women coming down to give birth to babies in Hong Kong.
More than 30,000 of them came last year, paying a premium to give birth in Hong Kong so their babies would have Hong Kong resident status and could go to better schools and hospitals in Hong Kong, even if their parents still live across the border. Hong Kongers complain that this is a drain on resources. Even mainland women who have Hong Kong husbands are protesting. A few heavily pregnant women and their supporters gathered recently outside the Hong Kong chief executive's office to deliver a petition. They want priority for hospital beds over mainlanders who have no Hong Kong ties. These are all issues that have raised Hong Kong ire. But there's more going on than anger over food in the subways or mainland women in Hong Kong hospitals. There's also been a shift in how Hong Kongers feel about being part of China.
Because Hong Kong is a free society, we treasure different views.
Robert Chung directs the University of Hong Kong's public opinion program.
And when we see dissidents in China being oppressed and being jailed, of course people are skeptical about it. That has been very clear to us and to, Chinese officials know that too.
For 20 years now, Chung has been doing regular surveys of how Hong Kong people see themselves. His most recent survey found that for the first time, a majority identify as Hong Konger rather than Chinese. That result has irritated the Chinese government. The response has been, metaphorically, to shoot the messenger. Hong Kong media with ties to China's Communist Party have called Chung a traitor and accused him of having ulterior motives.
That is not really welcome by me and by the Hong Kong society, because those are not civilized ways of discussing a problem. I don't mind discussing with anybody about the motive of our work, the findings of our work, the methodology of our work, but I think it has to be done in a very civilized way.
But that's not the way Hong Kong's Beijing-friendly leftist press operate, says government studies professor Ma Ok. He says they've been known to target individuals in Cultural Revolution-style smear campaigns, hoping both to discredit the target and dissuade others from speaking out.
The leftist press, so to speak, has always been unhappy about certain figures in Hong Kong because they think that they are anti-China. I think they are kind of testing the waters if they think that this will work, and if it can manage to silence some critics, they will continue to go on. But if it creates kind of a big outcry, then they will silence a little bit for a while, and then they will pick another time.
They'll have another opportunity next month. That's when Chung plans to run a civil referendum, a kind of shadow election, to see who Hong Kongers would elect as their leader if they were given that right. They were supposed to have had it 5 years ago. They'll have to wait at least another five. But there's always Chung's referendum.
It'll be internet voting plus, of course, on-site polling station type of voting. We think this would be some kind of futuristic technology for civil society participation.
And it's happening just days before a Beijing-approved group of delegates elects Hong Kong's next chief executive. There are two candidates acceptable to Beijing. Public opinion polls are already showing the one most favored by Beijing, Henry Tang, is polling in the low 20s. If Tang is chosen when he's known to be so unpopular, it could provoke an outcry from Hong Kongers, which could embarrass Beijing in a year when China faces its own leadership transition. In the midst of all this, Robert Chung says he's already getting more criticism for his plan to hold the civil referendum.
The commentators, the radical leftist commentators, they have already branded this activity as unconstitutional and with separatist motives.
Chung chuckles. In his sweater and wire-rimmed glasses, he looks pleasant and scholarly, hardly a threat to China's territorial integrity. And he's not, he says. He suggests his data could be useful to China's and Hong Kong's leaders to help them better understand and serve the people they govern. And that just might help more Hong Kongers be more accepting of their mainland compatriots and of their own status as citizens of the People's Republic of China. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead, Hong Kong.
I don't know about you, but I don't think I'll ever cease to be interested in stories like those. You know, there are thousands of them all over the world. They begin with language difference, and then they just spread. Language just speaks to so many other issues in the culture. And it's also just such a personal thing, language. And a quick word on the way Mary Kay told that story. She used the language of the people, simple, descriptive words. It didn't sound newsy, you know, in that self-conscious, newsy way. Well, maybe just for the sake of, I don't know, theater or something, I should sound newsy now. I need some important news bulletin music. At the end of their summit, world leaders issued a communique ratcheting up the pressure on Eurozone deniers. But advocates cite glaring omissions, which they say besmirch the gamesmanship of constitutional naysayers. The 11th hour clash has left the beleaguered heads battling over a violent crackdown, which has led to the destabilization of the international community. Okay, so that was a totally over-the-top mix of global English broadcast cliches with a few other words thrown in, courtesy of a fabulous website called newswordy.com. And these are all words that are overused by lazy journalists. And I'm fessing up right here. I'm as guilty as anyone else. The thing about these jargony words is that, aside from being really irritating, they make sentences incredibly difficult to understand, and not just when you turn them into nonsense like I did. Now, spare a thought for the editors and reporters who work in the foreign language services of organizations like the BBC and CNN and others. The BBC has 27 language services, but it also has a central news department that essentially decides what the top world stories of the day are. Those stories are then translated from English into the other languages, which is why it helps if the stories make sense in English and they're not totally jargony in the first place before they even get translated. What follows is a discussion of this among four BBC journalists, and here's where I'm going to make a complete fool of myself by trying to pronounce their names. We're going to hear from Artyom Lis of the Russian language service, also Na Pham of the Vietnamese service, and Rafid Jabouri of the Arabic service. Asking the questions is David Amanor.
Now, let me start with you. Is there a particular phrase commonly used in news reports that really annoys you?
Yeah, I always have concern when I see something in the copy saying, say, contentious issue, because I always think that, you know, if it is an issue, then it is contentious. So I try not to put it in my copies, but, you know, when I have to edit other colleagues' copies, I always take it off.
Artyom, former Soviet Union, you're Russian yourself, you're a Russian service editor, but which cliches or jargons particularly?
I was just thinking that, and I remember, nothing to do with Russia, I remember years ago going to our bureau in Jerusalem, and at the time they had a printout of a stock dispatch, a stock radio report on the wall of the bureau. The piece they had there printed out went along the lines of insert date here, a massive insert explosive device here, went off in insert neighborhood here, killing insert number of people here.
So it's basically a formula
it's
for news writing.
It's basically a formula for news writing, and that is really sloppy journalism.
Just coming back to everyday use of jargons and the clichés in news reports. I mean, things like the situation remains tense.
And the cycle of violence is set to continue, isn't it?
The cycle of violence, yeah. Let me turn to Rafid here. Rafid, because you're from Baghdad. And I guess, being from Baghdad, when you hear those kind of phrases, cycle of violence, situation remains tense, do you think you hear them more than the ordinary reporter or ordinary listener?
I think I do, and I have to admit that I frequently use them, so many of them. Sometimes it's you would think that it's easier to use them. Sometimes, you know, after a while, you would think that they are maybe the only way to refer to the real world or to express the real situation. I think it's everyone's in the editorial line's responsibility to remind each other how important is it to, you know, to expand the language.
But then, yeah. But then isn't there an issue of how far you can go in extending your vocabulary and your language? I do have a printout here. In the 1920s, ages and ages ago, there were two Russian writers who wrote a piece about a journalist who wrote along the lines of, you know, what we discussed today. And he did extend his vocabulary. Let me read you two quotes from his pieces, fictional pieces, of course. Mm-hmm. Waves hit the starboard of the ship in a frantic shaft drive motion. He was then, you know, in the book, he was then confronted by his editor saying, what exactly does a crankshaft drive motion mean? And he said, I have no idea, but it sounds really clever.
Exactly. And that's the danger of that journalists, and indeed all people, slip into. You're using phrases because they sound right, but they're actually not saying anything. Now, you're all from language services. So when it comes to translating those world news bulletins, for example, from English, complete with jargons, into languages for your respective audiences, there must be some problems there.
Of course. Yeah. It's always a challenge. It's a kind of impossible to translate jargons or maybe what become now idioms and expressions like the credit crunch. I think, you know, when this first emerged as a kind of casual phrase being used in the news 2-3 years ago, in BBC Arabic, I can remember that we just said financial crisis. So,
which is
fair enough.
Almost unproblematic translation in a way. I mean, you found something at least that more or less matches.
Yeah.
But this goes to all of you, sometimes when you just cannot translate an idiom, a phrase, into your respective languages.
For example, for a long time we've been talking about austerity measures that governments in Europe have been putting out.
Yeah, that's a good jargon, austerity. Yeah. How do you translate austerity in Vietnamese?
In Vietnamese, there is no austerity because we've been living very economically for a long time. So in Vietnamese, that would be translated to tightening your belt and shrinking your stomach. And
shrinking your stomach. Yeah, I quite like that. Yeah, I'd like to hear something like that in the BBC News, actually, in the next news bulletin. Yeah, the British Prime Minister has said that we have to be tightening our belts and shrinking our stomachs.
Isn't there a surgical procedure which allows you to do that?
Exactly. Maybe we could bring in BBC Science and health check as well on that. But what about politicians? What purpose does jargon serve for politicians? Because they tend to use a lot of artium.
I was just remembering there is an old Russian joke which has been doing the rounds on the internet, which is allegedly, and I don't believe it for a moment, but it's allegedly a quote from a Russian law, which says, if any person or persons find themselves understanding or approaching the understanding or comprehension of any part or all of this rule or law, they should contact the relevant authority immediately so the law can be changed. they basically try and hide, if it's a law, if it's a bill, they try and hide what they're really trying to say beneath this essentially pyramid of nonsensical words.
Rafid, you've had some experience with jargon on eliminating trenches.
That's correct.
Give us that example.
Yeah, eliminating the trenches of disagreement between the parties. That was, you know, very recent expression.
Who said that?
A former Iraqi prime minister. So that was quite new for me. And sometimes it could mean anything and nothing.
I want to go back to bugbears, you know, phrases, jargons that just wind you up a little. Artyom, I understand you don't like the phrase international community.
I don't, because I don't know what it means. Because you'd think that community is something where a group of people come together and they share a certain group of values and they share certain beliefs and views. Now, internationally, considering there are now 7 billion of us, is there really an international community? Or is the international community a sort of shorthand expression? What we're trying to say is people who think like ourselves are concerned. Mm-hmm. And I think we should just be more honest. It's more or less the same as saying experts believe, analysts feel, which is just a nice way for you to hide behind this sort of curtain and not to take responsibility for your own words.
Rafid, how about post-conflict society coming from Iraq? Post-conflict society. If you hear that 100 times in BBC News bulletins 1 week, would you get fed up with that one?
Well, in the end, it's all a matter of test and decency. If you think that it's being overused, it's your responsibility, as I said when we started, to expand the language that you use.
Rafid Jabouri of the BBC Arabic service ending that discussion of cheesy news cliches. And the discussion was over, but not the quiz that followed it. Back to David Amanor.
We've compiled some questions for you with a little help from the BBC News Style Guide, the Newswriter's Bible, which gives us the do's and don'ts of news writing. We've also given you some buzzers. Now you have the, what do you call those, castanet maracas. Atium, you have the squeaky lamb chop. And Rafid, you have the ding ding, the bicycle bell. So all on your buzzers. I'll repeat an often used cliche or phrase, and you tell us where the missing word is. First, the gunman went on a killing...
Spree.
The current lull is clearly the calm before the... Artyom.
Double dip recession. Storm, really.
Storm. You're thinking way ahead, Artyom. The strike was called off at the 11th...
Hour.
11th hour. The 11th hour. That's an interesting one now. You're smiling about that one. The 11th hour. What on earth does it mean?
I have no idea.
Artyom, enlighten us.
That's very clear, isn't it? It was called off at 22 hours, 59 minutes, just before midnight.
It's a very often used phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
On your buzzers again. The police say they will leave no stone...
Unturned.
No stone unturned. And when they found the motive behind the crime, it was a moment of...
Truth.
Indeed, yeah. Now, there can't be a better truism than that. When they found the truth, it was a moment of...
Truth.
Okay, quiz over. I'd like to repeat all the names of David Amanor's guests there, but I don't think I want to put myself or you through any more mispronunciations. And we can hardly cover newsy words without making reference in some way to the language of tabloid news. Now, here in the US, that tabloid news language isn't exactly thriving in the tabloids, outside of New York City anyway. It's, for the most part, on TV. But in Britain, tabloid language is still alive. And I'm dropping the word news here from tabloid news language because, well, tabloids often drop news from the pages too, especially one particular page, page 3. That's the notorious picture spread in Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper, which is essentially a massive picture with almost no room for any text. And the picture is of a topless woman. The only connection to, well, any kind of news on that particular page, maybe the woman is, I don't know, dating a professional soccer player, something like that. Now, The Sun remains Britain's top-selling newspaper, but it's been kind of sucked into the police investigation into Murdoch's News Corporation. And that's the investigation that led to the closure of The Sun's Sunday sister paper, The News of the World. Now, it was phone hacking that killed The News of the World. And now some believe that allegations of payments to police officers from Sun journalists, that if they are proven... That could kill off The Sun. The police have already arrested several Sun journalists. Rupert Murdoch, he's responded bullishly. He's launched a new Sunday edition of The Sun called The Sunday Sun. And, well, you might be wondering, why do we care about any of this? Well, for one thing, The Sun is hugely politically influential. Before any election in Britain, political leaders line up for The Sun's support. And then also there's The Sun's contribution to the language. The Sun essentially redefined tabloid discourse. Here are three memorable front page headlines. Freddie Starr ate my hamster. Okay, well, back in the day, that was groundbreaking. Harry the Nazi. That's Prince Harry, by the way. And on election day, 1992, if Kinnock, that's the Labour Party leader, Neil Kinnock, if Kinnock wins today, will the last person to leave Britain please turn out the lights? I love the addition of the word please in that headline. Well, the new Sun on Sunday, in its first edition, didn't really dip into the full palette of tabloid language. And I guess it's unlikely to do so. The times have changed and all of that. But even if it's half as colourful as the Sun of the 1970s and 80s, it'll be funny, it'll be caustic, it'll be mean-spirited in just about equal measures. Here's a brief report on the best and the worst of The Sun. Well, mainly the worst. There's more of that after all. It's from the BBC's Andrew Hoskin, and it begins with some typically breathless headlines.
Why is Kylie called Rosa? Why did Craig wear a dress? Alan's battle to marry his Miss Australia.
The scandals and the arrests may have clouded many people's view of The Sun. Some have even forecast a final setting behind a dark horizon. but there's no denying the influence it's had on the country's newspapers, politics and culture.
Pints in the sun this week. And
few people in 1969 took much notice when an obscure newspaper tycoon from Australia called Rupert Murdoch purchased a tired Labour-supporting broadsheet called The Sun for £800,000.
You've seen us all on television, now read about our private lives.
Under Murdoch, it rapidly became your super soar-away sun. Aggressive, exuberant and in your face, often shedding as much, if not more, heat than light. All the iconoclasm of the proprietor was on display. In a year, page three girl arrived and she stayed.
Hello, boys. Look at your woman. Now back to me. Now back at your woman. Now back to me. Sadly, she isn't me. But that's okay, because if you keep reading page three every day, I'll be in your hands.
If the Times was bought by the people who ran the country and the Daily Mail by the wives of the people who ran the country, then the Sun was bought by the people who didn't care who ran the country, as long as she had, well, I'm sure you know how the rest of the joke goes. It's quite old now.
Have to see. Look again. The tickets are now beers.
Politically, the Sun has proved extremely unfaithful. It became more fickle as its circulation and perceived political influence grew, dropping Labour in the 70s to become Thatcherite in the 80s, then dumping the Tories for Blair in the late 90s and Brown for Cameron in the late noughties. With clout came chutzpah. After the election of April 1992, the front page claimed it was the Sun what won it for the Tories. But the Sun often made news too.
Argentina says that its cruiser, the General Belgrano, torpedoed by a British nuclear-powered submarine late last night, is presumed sunk.
Gotcha, it proclaimed in 1982 when news broke of the sinking of the General Belgrano. The headline was quietly changed for later editions when it emerged that 323 Argentine sailors had died.
There's been a major tragedy involving football fans at the FA Cup semi-final.
Probably the paper's biggest unforced error came in 1989 with its calamitous coverage of the Hillsborough football disaster in which 96 fans died. Supporters were wrongly accused of urinating on police and pickpocketing the dead.
A few minutes after this afternoon.
But even the Hillsborough affair pales beside the current crisis, with the arrests of reporters and executives and the hauling of others before Lord Justice Leveson. Hardly the most propitious time to launch a Sunday version, perhaps. But even in its darkest hour, it seems, the sun also rises.
OK, finally, mademoiselle, the French word for miss or unmarried woman. The French government has issued a directive to bureaucrats and businesses affecting all such women. It recommends that the word mademoiselle be phased out. So from now on, women will no longer be asked to choose between identifying themselves as madame, married, or mademoiselle, not so. The big show's Adeline Sieyès was born in France, so very well qualified to tell Lisa Mullins just how often it came up for French women that they'd have to pick a title for themselves.
In France, you used to have to always choose between madame or mademoiselle, Mrs. or miss, for any transaction, whether it's obtaining a credit card, applying for a job, a driver's license, a lease, or even ordering anything online, no matter how irrelevant the title was for this transaction. So this is great news for many women in France and feminist groups who had been pushing for this change for years. They said women should not have to disclose their marital status randomly, and in fact that men never had to do it because they always go by monsieur or mister, no matter what.
So how about Ms.? Is that going to be an option?
There is no equivalent for Ms. in France. And so France has taken a long time to make this change happen. In Germany, for example, they have phased out the word Fraulein, Miss, in the 70s. In France, they didn't. They're just getting to it now. The word mademoiselle, as of this week, should be phased out, will be replaced by madame, no matter what your status is, Mrs., no matter what your status is. And also, forms will not ask you for your maiden name anymore, but your family name, or your commonly used name, which sort of makes it also more simple, more neutral. That said, this is not a law, so there isn't that much pressure to adopt this new measure. And France being a big bureaucratic country, it'll be a while before any administrative form containing the words madame and mademoiselle have completely run out.
Aline, everybody see this as a good thing?
Not all see this as a good thing. First, one prominent feminist said today, if you really wanted a woman's status to remain neutral or private, you should stick to Mademoiselle or Miss all your life, whether you get married, take on your husband's name, get divorced or whatever. Others say, well, this is an election year in France, and this is President Sarkozy trying to appeal to women voters. That's what some people say. Also, some people point out to the fact that there are bigger issues when it comes to parity between men and women in France. Equal pay for equal job is still a big issue there. On average, men make 20% more than women.
Now, Adeline, not to get too personal, but I know you have sisters who live in France, and I wonder what they think of this.
Yes, I do have two sisters, and they think a little differently about this. My sister Agnès prefers Mademoiselle in all situations because she says it makes her feel younger than her years. And I have to say here in the U.S., I also prefer to be addressed as Miss randomly rather than Ma'am, which sounds a bit dowdy, and I feel like it dates me. My other sister, Bénédicte, prefers Madame because she feels it is more neutral. But one thing we all have in common, we all hope that French men will stop asking women randomly, are you madame or mademoiselle, you know, with a wink and a smirk, you know, as a way to find out whether a woman is married or potentially available. That's just really slimy. So I hope this gets naturally phased out too.
The Big Show's Adeline Cyr, Madame Adeline Cyr, as she signed her blog post, speaking with Lisa Mullins. That's it for this week. And here's a call for comments. Later this year, I don't know, probably around sometime in the summer, I'm thinking of tweaking the pod just a little bit so that it has more frequent episodes, but a lot of them would be shorter. I'd still have long interviews from time to time, like, you know, the recent two-parter with Michael Erard. I've got one with Elizabeth Little coming up. She's written a book about the backstory to the many languages you can find in the U.S. if you poke around, you know, Navajo, Norwegian, and stuff that's more obscure than that. And I'll still do the rip from the headline stuff with Carol, of course. But I'd also like to do pods that last, you know, 5 or 10 minutes in between. There are a ton of items that they're just kind of time sensitive, and I feel that sometimes I sit on them for too long right now. I wait to pair them with something else, and I just like to put them out a little bit quicker. So, for you, dear listener, what do you think about the idea of more podcasts, but also of more varying length? And I promise that if everyone hates the idea, I won't do it. I know that there are some people who like the, you know, 20 to 35 minute length. It just works well for their commute or workout or what have you. Tweet me your thoughts. I'm on Twitter at Patrick Cox, PatriCox. Or you can post something at the World in Words Facebook page. Or you can email me. That address is language@pri.org. Send me your comments, your thoughts, your insults. Thank you very much. See you next time, and farewell, Mademoiselle. Il se maquille pour ressembler à une fille. Il est très belle, se fait appeler Mademoiselle.